Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the topic is the left eating itself. Is it destroying itself? What has become of the left? With identity politics and insensitivity to open dialogue, censoring people, trying to prevent people from being able to speak on a college campus, labeling everyone as a racist or a bigot or a white supremacist or just being white is enough to trigger some people. What have we become? We've been led to believe that women are so hypersensitive today that they can't handle the kind of dialogue that goes on in the real world. Of course, that's not true. But for a certain group of people, they've made this a platform. They've made this a big issue. For others, they begin to look at the President of the United States and say, well, he is white and he is powerful and he is a bigot and he's a racist, he's misogynist, and look at him and then project that out to all white men. It is so wrong what is happening. And yet there doesn't seem to be a clarion call for more reasoned and wise voices coming forward to say, we have gone too far. Let us take a look at how we got here and how we need to go to a more responsible way of dialoguing. I may disagree with someone, but I'm not going to censor them, and I certainly wouldn't suggest to this audience that you should boycott the sponsors of another program so that they will be forced off the air through attrition. My belief is that, and I'm one of those absolutists on the First Amendment, that I can disagree with everything you're saying. I still allow, in my mind, you have the right to say it. I also have told this audience on numerous occasions, with all the serious issues in the world that we're not addressing. For example, a family of 20 at a wedding ceremony was destroyed. Men, women, and children, babies, just 2 days ago in Yemen. You wouldn't have known about that in the American media. Why not? Well, because the perpetrator is Saudi Arabia. They pay big bucks for allegiance. And we provided them with the missiles, and the drones, and the surveillance, and the jets, even boots on the ground. How is it that we can't have an open and honest dialogue about regime change? We've engaged in it on 81 occasions since the 1900s in the 20th century. But we can't. We're always seeing ourselves as exceptional defenders of democracy. But by what standards? So today, we're going to have some discussion on this. We're going to hear four people. And these people are some pretty good thinkers. They're raising some completely legitimate arguments. We're going to hear from Brendan O'Neill, a senior editor of Spike Magazine, which is in and of itself a far-left, more humanistic publication. Professor Laura Kipnis, also Professor Agvi Johnson, Professor Brett Weinstein. It's going to last about 25 to 30 minutes. And then I'm going to ask the audience who would like to participate, call in and share your points of view. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. And then I'll share a commentary that I have, depending upon how many people call in. If no one calls in, I'll just have a lot to say. And if you do call in, I'll be happy to have you on board to hear what you have to say. Now let's go to New York University Law Library. Packed house, by the way, and four individuals sitting on a stage with a moderator. He'll do the introductions, and then each one of these people have about 7 or 8 minutes to make their arguments. And then you can agree or disagree, but let's see what points they raise that are not being discussed, not even in an open forum. That's why we're doing this.
Everyone, hello. Thank you so much for coming, and welcome to this Spiked US Unsafe Space Tour event, Is the Left Eating Itself? My name's Tom Slater. I'm deputy editor of Spiked, the online magazine. I'm also coordinating this Unsafe Space Tour, and I'll be moderating this evening. Thank you all for coming. Also, big thank you to the New York Law School for hosting us, being just about the only college on Manhattan who would have us after the antics we've been getting up to on the previous couple of dates, and also to Nadine Strossen, who is a professor here at the New York Law School, former president of the ACLU, great defender of free speech, who is hosting tonight. There we go. So she's hosting us tonight, even though she's not actually here. But nevertheless, she's with us in spirit. So, is the left eating itself? So at Spiked, we're a left-wing radical humanist magazine, and we've always stuck up for free speech, no ifs and no buts. And as a result of that, you often find yourself defending the right to speak of people who you either vehemently disagree with or downright despise. But what's been quite interesting is that whilst seemingly even about over the last 10 years, you could say that generally speaking, the sorts of speakers on a campus or more broadly who would find themselves protested against, the subject of calls for censorship, tended to be conservatives, right-wingers, through to downright reactionaries. Things seem to be changing over the last couple of years. So not only does it seem that the bar for censorship, for what is beyond the pale on campus, seems to be getting lower and lower, but even avowed left-wingers, progressives, feminists even have found themselves the subjects of protests and calls for censorship from campus activists. And a number of those people are actually on this panel tonight, but even beyond that, you don't have to go far to look for examples of it, whether it's the feminist Jermaine Greer being picketed for her views on transgenderism, or someone like Slavoj Žižek, who was protested at the Left Forum here in New York last year for some colourful comments he'd made previously about the refugee crisis. So that's really what we want to look at tonight, that dynamic, if indeed it does exist. And have today's young radicals abandoned freedom of speech? Are they turning on their forebears? Or is something else going on? Are they simply holding previous generations of progressives to a higher standard? And indeed, is this all just a little bit overblown? Are these unrepresentative groups of students who, for whatever reason, universities and institutions are capitulating to? So that's the sort of thing we're going to be getting into tonight. And I'm delighted to be joined by what is, to my mind, the perfect panel to discuss this. So I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they'll speak. So first up, my immediate left is Brendan O'Neill. Brendan is the editor of Spiked. He's also a columnist for Reason and The Spectator, the author most recently of A Duty to Offend. And most pertinently for this evening, he was banned from the University of Oxford in 2014 at a debate on abortion, where he was due to make the pro-choice case on the basis that he, as a person without a uterus, their words, wasn't sufficiently credited to contribute to that debate. So it'll be interesting to hear from Brendan. Speaking after Brendan, on his left is Laura Kipnis, known to many of you, I'm sure. Laura is a feminist, essayist, and academic. She's a professor of media studies at Northwestern University and the author of many books, but most recently, Unwanted Advances, which really builds on a lot of her critiques of what she calls sexual paranoia on campus. And her writing on this subject has not only earned us some protests at Northwestern, but also some pretty shocking Title IX investigations, which I'm sure we'll hear a little bit about as well. So it's fantastic to have Laura here. Speaking after Laura, we've got Angus Johnston. Angus is a historian of student activism and student government. He's a professor at the City University of New York. He's contributed to many publications, Rolling Stone, The Chronicle of Higher Education, Inside Higher Ed. You might have seen him on MSNBC and C-SPAN. And he regularly speaks on campus and is a very staunch and passionate defender of student activism past and present. So it'll be fascinating to see what Angus has to say tonight. And then finally, on my far left, we've be hearing from Brett Weinstein. So Brett is an evolutionary theorist and a former professor of biology at Evergreen State College. The reason he is former is the fact that, as many of you will know, he was at the center of a big national news story when he criticized an anti-racist protest on campus, which was asking white student and faculty to stay away from the day. As a result, the subject of a lot of protests and calls for his resignation. So our speakers are going to speak for about 5 to 7 minutes tops. We may have a little bit of discussion on the panel, but as quickly as possible, I'm going to throw it out to you guys for your questions and your comments. And that's how we'll go for the rest of the evening. So, Brendan, do you want to kick us off?
Thanks, Tom. My answer to the question, is the left eating itself, is no. For the simple reason that what we have on campuses in the US and the UK today is not left. This hyper-racial consciousness, this insistence on female fragility, this paranoid philistinism, so that books are defaced with trigger warnings, and everything from tabloid newspapers to sexy pop songs can be banned. This disavowal of your own autonomy, your own adulthood, and your pleading with bureaucracy to provide you with psychic comfort, this use of racial phrases like white men, as if all white men have the same privilege, as if class, the building block of left politics, was irrelevant or such a small thing that it didn't bear talking about. None of this is left. None of this is what I understand to be left. In fact, it has far more in common with the politics of reaction than it does with the politics of the left. It is a replay, in my view, of the carnivals of reaction that greeted the rise of Enlightenment thought, the birth of mass democracy, the liberation of women and ethnic minorities from second-class oblivion. In my view, today's campus agitators better resemble the reaction against those progressive radical leaps forward for humankind than they do the progressive radical leaps forward themselves. They are not left. I know this sounds like semantics, but it's incredibly important that we get this right. I know they call themselves left, but North Korea calls itself a democratic republic. People lie. And more importantly, people use progressive phrases to disguise reactionary agendas. That is a long-standing historical phenomenon, and that is what we face on campus today. The dressing up of the new reaction against Enlightenment thought as something progressive. I think what we face on campus today and across many institutions in the West is something far worse than left-on-left battles. We face the slow-motion, agonizing death of Enlightenment thought and the return of reactionary ideas. Just on why I think they are not left-wing, and we really must stop calling them left-wing, just a few examples. The first thing is that this new campus radicalism completely grates against the idea of universalism, which is one of the key ideas of left-wing politics from the French Revolution onwards. The idea of the common man, the rejection of the biology or the politics of race and the politics of division in favor of emphasizing common interests. The new radicalism completely grates against that. It does it through always emphasizing the fragility of black students, the culpability of white students who benefit from historical privilege and therefore are culpable for the crimes of history. You know, when I visit American campuses, I'm really shocked by the politics that is on offer to students. It's either black self-pity or white self-loathing. That seems to me to be the only options in radical politics on campus today, a highly racialized, hyper-racial politics. And it's really emphasized in the phrase, stay in your lane. Don't ever dare to mix too much with the other race or offer too much solidarity to the other race because you're getting above yourself. You should stay in your lane. You can also see it in the way in which this new radicalism completely grates against the idea of class. As I was saying earlier, their use of the phrase white men, this amorphous phrase, you know, white men are bad, of course, all white men are bad, even the white men who historically helped to develop the Enlightenment and radical thinking and so on. They're all bad, they're all the same, and they all enjoy privilege. It's complete negation of the idea of class, the key dividing line in modern society, and the foundation stone of left-wing politics. You can also see the way it's not left in the way it demeans women and ethnic minorities. Women are presented as fragile, as requiring Victorian-style chaperoning through daily life. They couldn't possibly negotiate the ups and downs of public life and student life and sex life on their own. You know, you think that's left-wing. Can you imagine Rosa Luxemburg or Frida Kahlo, famous communists who had affairs with all sorts of people, shrinking in case if someone offered to buy them a drink or if someone touch them on the shoulder. It's ridiculous. This is not left. They demean ethnic minorities, too, with their acquiescence to the idea of micro aggressions, where everyday conversation is presumed to be hurtful to certain minority groups, or their championing of the removal of certain statues or the renaming of certain buildings. I've heard radical students talk about the environmental menace of statues of old white men, as if ethnic minority students are incapable of walking past a statue without being wounded by it. It is not left to push such a demeaning racial view of certain groups in society. And in fact, what it does, it actually reinvents the biological determinism of the old racial politics, but in the language of historical determinism. They are wounded by history. So in so many different ways, this is not left. This is a reactionary, illiberal politics. And in my view, it has far more in common with the old reactionary politics, particularly the reactionary politics that emerged in the aftermath of the development of Enlightenment thought. And there was a famous reactionary 18th century French philosopher who hated the Enlightenment. He thought it was the worst thing that ever happened. And his famous line was, his name was Joseph de Maistre, his famous line was, "There is no such thing as man." He said, there are French men, there are Italian men, there are black men, there are white men, there are poor men, there are rich men, but there is no such thing as man. And whenever I hear student radicals crying about white men, black people, women, and everyone having different ideas and different views, and the need to control public interaction to protect people's feelings, I always hear the echo of that anti-universal, anti-progressive, anti-radical cry, there is no such thing as man. I think what we have to recognize is that on campus right now, we face something far worse than left versus left, or left versus right, or the alt-right coming in and stirring things up, and left-wing people crying as a consequence. We face a generation that has been schooled to reject Enlightenment thought, schooled to reject due process, schooled to reject freedom of speech, schooled to reject the ideal of autonomy, and encouraged to see themselves as fragile and weak and requiring bureaucratic therapeutic scaffolding in every area of their lives. That is not left. That is the opposite of left. That is the opposite of radical, and it needs to be challenged by everyone who seriously considers themselves to be a left-wing person.
Thank you, Brendan.
There you go.
So, Laura, your thoughts, please.
Okay. Well, in answer to the question posed, I'm also going to say provisionally no. I thought I was going to be the first one to say no. If by left we mean broadly anti-capitalist, and if by eating itself we mean broadly the free speech on campus issue, which I take to be the subtext here. I'm saying no, though for a while, even recently, I might have said yes. So let me briefly describe my journey. I don't come to punditry, that is the task of delivering oracular pronouncements in public, especially happily. I'm a left-wing feminist who wrote some controversial things about sexual politics on campus because I find the direction of campus feminism also at the moment conservative-leaning and indeed paternalistic. Some people tried to shut me up by bringing me up on Title IX complaints, in fact, twice. So I wrote about the experience of people misusing the Title IX process to shut people up, and later about other misuses of Title IX I'd learned about and found myself plunked unexpectedly into the middle of the free speech debates and on the receiving end of a bunch of speaking invites from various groups with a pro-free speech agenda. As someone whom others have tried to shut up, I should naturally endorse the free speech agenda, both out of self-interest and because politically I favor freedom and disfavor authoritarianism. I could easily use my allotted time to rant about campus authoritarians and so on. Instead, for this occasion, I'm going to try out the role of the anti-pundit and speak about the value of negative capability, which was Keats's phrase for the usefulness of intellectual confusion and uncertainty, and the ability to think two opposing things at once, which is parenthetically what the political situation of the moment demands of us, I believe. To take a rigid, unequivocal position or positions in the midst of political disarray, in which the democratic experiment looks increasingly imperiled, in which calling your opponents fascists is no longer hyperbole, is to risk being an idiot. When events are unfolding faster than the adequacy of our language to describe it, I suspect our positions should be provisional and lightly held. In that spirit, and against my own self-interest, let me try on the anti-free speech position espoused by certain segments of the left, but at its best version rather than its shrillest or its stupidest, which is what I think an intellectually honest interlocutor wants to do occasionally, entertain the possibility that your deeply cherished principles might require retooling in response to changing circumstances or new information. As a leftist myself, that is, an anti-capitalist, I have to start by acknowledging the correctness of the premise that there's basically no such thing as free speech. There's no free marketplace of ideas because some idea mongers have more purchasing power than others or a better position in the idea marketplace. Markets don't produce equality and never have. In fact, they produce massive inequality. Look around. Check out some wealth and income distribution data. In this context, I do find it difficult to deny that the free speech argument is a comforting illusion, a cover for the fact that powerful interests determine who can speak and who gets heard and by how many. Will net neutrality last for another 5 minutes, by the way? But I suppose that's the subject for another discussion. Here's a personal example closer to our topic. As a supposed free speech advocate, I myself have been the beneficiary of numerous speaking invites, sometimes with quite nice honoraria attached, to events where there are not infrequently lavish catered dinners where you get served expensive things like filet mignon, because I came to realize the free speech agenda is a well-funded one, with various foundations, often libertarian slash conservative ones, funneling money from donors whose politics align in not uncomplicated ways, i.e. anti-regulatory economic policies, with this idea and not other ideas. The other ideas don't get the filet mignon. If you're Black Lives Matter or Antifa, you're probably lucky to get bus fare. As an anti-pundit, I also have to acknowledge that there's no credible absolutist position on free speech. When John Stuart Mill said back in the 1860s that more speech was the solution to bad speech, there were certain structural exclusions he was ignoring. Did freed men and freed women have access to the marketplace of ideas? No, because to have access to free speech, you have to be able to represent yourself, to be part of the discourse. It's not a birthright, it's a political right that, in the case of historically underrepresented populations, has to be fought for. Which brings us to identity politics, which I take to be the other subtext of the question we've been asked to answer. As a leftist, that is, in favor of a politics of redistribution, how can I not be on the side of identity politics? Because I have to recognize that access to resources depends, first of all, on the ability of marginalized groups to be represented. There are better and worse versions of identity politics. Let's pick the best one. Nancy Fraser's formulation about recognition versus redistribution is useful here. We need both. That doesn't mean bowing to the language of microaggressions. It means that you only have to look at wealth and income distribution patterns to know that identity isn't a meaningless category, nor has race somehow been transcended. Okay, but here comes a contradiction. I promised you some. Look, I fully believe there's a fatal anti-intellectualism sweeping American campuses that has to be addressed, and much of it revolves around identity politics and campus cultures that increasingly favor feelings over intellect. When I see videos of demonstrators at Evergreen or Wesleyan saying they don't need to read books because we know what our experiences have been, and shouting down faculty, I too want to blame identity politics. But that's to be as simplistic as the students who want to shut people up who offend or trigger them. Instead, we on campus, and I mean faculty, have to help students get over the theory versus experience dichotomy and understand that experience in itself by itself is meaningless. The only way to make sense of it is with distance and retrospect. At the same time, All speech and all ideas don't have a place on campus. There are intellectual standards to be maintained and principles to uphold. And most importantly, the most important one is that campuses are inclusive places, not venues to debate whether blacks or Muslims or trans students deserve social equality. Those debates have been settled. If student Republicans want to invite alt-right and edgy neo-fascist speakers, they can invite them to off-campus venues. If it were 1932, would we invite Joseph Goebbels to campus to debate whether Jews and homosexuals should be removed from Germany on the principle that good speech will obviously trump bad speech and all ideas deserve a hearing? No, and campus presidents should not be doling out hundreds of thousands of dollars in security costs to protect idiots with ignominious ideas that are opposed to our core values. The Goebbels analogy isn't very far-fetched at the moment, as we know. We have white supremacists running the executive branch. We have fascist gangs with guns terrorizing cities and mowing down those who get in their way. African-American voting rights are being systematically clawed back. And yesterday I read in the Times about a white 18-year-old student at the University of Hartford boasting on social media that she tried to poison her black roommate. Yes, I know all the invite Milo to campus arguments. Who do we want to appoint as the idea gatekeepers, etc.? But if fascists and racists want to exclude certain identities from the future, these aren't ideas, they're threats. And we have to start making that distinction. The time to stop inviting fascists to campus is right around now. And as a bonus, maybe the Antifa would stay home too.
Sorry, Laura, if I could ask you to just final thought before we move
okay,
on to
Okay, this is my final thought. Do I contradict myself? Maybe so. Do I know how these ideas would work in practice? No. Do some of our comrades fail on the negative capability front? Do they have excess certainty? Are they maybe a bit too quick on the pronouncements and denunciations? Yes. Are they too quick to play the role of authoritarians and censors? Not exactly new tendencies, as we know. Yes, again, but let's be tough-minded and generous and take them at their best.
Thank you very much, Laura. I should say now, Laura, if you're expecting filet mignon tonight, you're going to be bitterly disappointed. But Angus, your thoughts, please.
Thank you. I have a feeling, well, I don't know what Brett's going to do, but so far we're 3-for-3 on answering the question no. But I really mean it, actually. I really, really mean it. We're obviously in a moment of incredible crisis as a country, right? I will confess that I find the idea that white male is a useless or amorphous category a little confusing in a time when Donald Trump is the president of the United States, an aficionado and a maestro of white male identity politics, right? This is a moment in history when the politics of white male identity have been are not only ascendant but weaponized, right? And that doesn't mean that every white male is evil. I hope that that's not the case. But it doesn't mean that whiteness and maleness and all of that are topics that we need to be thinking about and engaging with. And the idea that we can have a universal left is one that I find very appealing in a lot of ways, but you don't get universalism by erasing difference, right? You don't get universalism by pretending that there are no distinctions to be made between us, and you don't get universalism by pretending that we are not all oppressed in different ways and along different axes. That the way that we can build a left that speaks for us all is to build a left that speaks for us all, and that speaks for each of us in our specificity and speaks to our specificity in the various ways in which we are being run roughshod. A left politics in the United States in the 21st century has to be a coalitional politics. It cannot be anything other than a coalitional politics. And so from that perspective, my concerns about the concept of free speech are in some ways similar to Laura's, although I'd take it a little bit further and say, I'm somebody who's been beating a very big drum for the free speech rights of left-wing students over the last year or two, or several, 10. And I have not been given a single filet mignon for that position. There's a lot of folks who are really, really into free speech who are relatively quiet when we're talking about the free speech of rowdy students on campus. And I think we do have a difficulty here that goes back to the way in which we conceptualize civil liberties. I'm an ACLU guy, I'm a First Amendment absolutist guy, and as I was growing up, right, thinking about the concept of free speech, the place you would always go was Skokie, right? That was the example that you would always give, that if you really were for free speech, you had to be for the free speech of the Nazis in Skokie. And the way that that was formulated was that to be for free speech means to be most of all for the free speech of the people that you hate the most. And the people that you hate the most are the Nazis, so that's where you go. I think that's wrong. I think that to be for free speech means that you have to be for the free speech the most of the people whose free speech is most under attack, right? If the people that you hate the most are relatively privileged in terms of having the ability to avail themselves of their First Amendment rights, then they're not the people that you need to be supporting the most. The people you need to be supporting most are the people who are the most under attack. It is very easy to defend the people that we really, really hate who are the exact opposite of us. It's a lot harder to defend the people who we really, really hate who are kind of like us. The people who are sort of kind of on our team, but we think are completely messing it up, that's the people it's really hard to defend. That's the people it's really hard to be in solidarity with. Do I have like a minute left?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, excellent, great. I won't use them both. We talk a lot right now about the free speech movement at Berkeley in 1964, particularly when Yiannopoulos was coming to campus, right, and he was being thrown off campus and people were rioting against him. Everybody was talking about how all of this was a betrayal of the principles of the free speech movement at Berkeley. And, you know, I'm a historian of student activism. I believe powerfully in that moment and that movement. It's one of the places that I think of American students as being truly heroic. But the crucial moment, right, the crucial historical moment in the free speech movement at Berkeley was that speech that Mario Savio gave. Right, the most famous speech in the history of American student activism, the cornerstone speech of the Berkeley free speech movement, literally a speech that has been inscribed in stone. And the peroration of that speech, the climax of that speech, is this paragraph. There comes a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. This is not the language of a man who wants to sit down and debate the people who he is opposed to. This is not the language of a man who is insisting that the people who are oppressing him need to be given a forum. This is the language of a man who is putting his body upon the wheels and upon the gears and upon the levers. And I think that we on the left need to make at least some sort of an effort to reach out to the people who are also on the left, who are putting their bodies upon the wheels and upon the gears and upon the levers right now. Thanks.
Thank you, Angus. And Brett, your thoughts, please.
Yes, it's
my professorial instincts are kicking in, and I feel like I should try to synthesize what I've been hearing and challenge a few things, but I'm going to try to stick to the plan. The plan is to address the question, is the left eating itself? And I think there are a couple of ways that we can answer this question. One is yes. Another would be, yes, of course it is. I mean, that may be my lived experience speaking here, but it seems so transparently obvious that that is what is going on that I feel inclined really to move on to the more interesting question, which is why is the left eating itself? But that does mean that I have to address some of what's been said here. How can we disagree? If it's so obvious to me that the left is eating itself, then how am I sitting on a panel with people who are obviously well-spoken and informed, maybe more so than I am, who disagree? And I think, in part, it's going to come down to definitions, which could be a very semantic, dry discussion, were it not for the reason that the definitions are in flux. And so I think we should probably get there soon enough. For the moment, what I want to do is suggest a kind of approach to understanding why this really is the left that is attacking some of us who all our lives would have called ourselves leftists. And the first thing I would suggest is that we may have a basic problem with the game theory of progressivism. It is quite possible that what is taking place is that the left has a bad actor problem that arises out of some of the fundamental assumptions of progressivism. And I don't mean to strike a negative note. I do think it is possible to structure a left that would be more or less immune to a bad actor problem. But what I'm witnessing in the present are bad actors that have control over the entire dialogue, and that is a very dangerous situation. The first thing that I recognized a bit before things went haywire at Evergreen, or at least went haywire publicly, was that the people I was talking to, and most of the population at Evergreen is pretty far left, but I recognized that there was a hidden dichotomy between two populations within the left. One of those populations earnestly wishes equality, and there can be some debate over what it is that is being equalized, but virtually everybody on the left would say that they are for equality of opportunity. Then there is another population that does not wish equality of opportunity. What it wishes to do is to turn the tables of oppression. And the problem for us is that when these two populations are intermingled, they sound alike until the point that you reach something like equality of opportunity, and we are nowhere near that point. At that point, they would clearly diverge, and you would discover that some of the people who had been pursuing some nominal version of equality were really about some radical version of inequity with new people at the head. And I do think that that's what we are facing. And the most confusing aspect of it is that the people who are earnestly seeking something like equality of opportunity are unaware that they have signed up with something unholy and un-American. One of the consequences of this dichotomy, the bad actors having taken control of the movement, is that they have begun to erect structures that lead a lot of people to sign up before they really know what it is that they're signing up for. So you'll find across the dialogue of the left at the moment, you'll find words that once upon a time had a definition that you might have struggled a little bit to resurrect it, but you could have figured out what words like equity probably meant. And those words have taken on very different meanings in the present. And they're actually part of a larger structure. So we have what I would call linguistic booby traps. We have policy proposals on college campuses and elsewhere that are actually Trojan horses that are described as pursuing one thing but actually serve a function other than the one that is on the title page. And then we have stigma that is playing an incentivizing role, or actually more correctly, a disincentivizing role. So people like myself who stand up against policy proposals that put my institution in jeopardy find ourselves faced with a social penalty for having done so. And it seems funny in my case. They came after me with the accusation that I was a racist, and then it turned out that there were a lot of people who could tell you that wasn't true, so it backfired on them a bit. But in fact, none of these stigmatizing concepts really depends on being accurate. The most important thing that they do is they isolate you. And that is a means to an end. It is not; these are not logical arguments that are being deployed. These are this is leverage that is being wielded against individuals that are considered troubling from the point of view of the movement. And I would argue that the best way to conceptualize what this movement really is to understand that we don't get to listen in on most of the actual dialogue that results in the structuring. What we listen in on is the public face of this movement. And the movement is really properly understood as an insurgency that privately has decided that it is entitled to disrupt the functioning of certain things that it regards as, quote-unquote, problematic, and that once it has decided that you are problematic, there are no holds barred. If you recognize it as an insurgency and you stop listening to what it says it is attempting to accomplish, it will be much clearer what is taking place. Maybe that's where I should leave off in light of the differences of opinion on the panel. Probably the best thing we can do is...
All right, four very intelligent people who have spent a lifetime on the left politically, all of those individuals have found themselves under attack by people on the left. What do you make of this phenomena? I'm going to share a few of my thoughts now, and I'm opening the forum if anyone in the audience, normally we don't take any calls on our Progressive Commentary Hour, but I'm making that exception today. You can call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We'd like to hear from you. If a person is liberal, or for that matter, if a person is conservative in both the historical terms, you do not want pollution of our environment. You don't want to see it degraded. You don't want to see the degradation of neighborhoods. You want to see some stability, something that offers all of us an opportunity for quality of life. And there was a time in America we had that, generally from the 1940s, right after the war, even before the war ended, right up through the mid-1970s. So we had 30 years where more people were going to college than ever before. There were those of us who were out protesting what we considered the wrongs being done in everyone's name, like the Vietnam War, for example. And we were pushing back against the most obvious and odious of the contemporary paradigms of racism that had been institutionalized in the South, and bigotry and misogyny, the glass ceilings. And we fought against those. Then I'm going to jump ahead and give you an example of how the left is eating itself and has lost all credibility. All. And that's why progressivism has taken its place. Where the Democrats, registered as Democrats, are around 22 to 24%, and Republicans are around 18 to 21%. Independents are the majority. They dwarf both of those put together. They're just not organized. They just know what they no longer want to participate in. They no longer want to watch their films or their television reality shows. They're pulling off the grid, but they're doing it quietly. They're not doing it as a movement. And I'll give you a couple examples, because I've not only had the opportunity and privilege of serving with others in movements, but also in many cases leading those movements, demonstrations, articles, documentaries that are used by millions of people in a different movement. I'm expected at some level to go out there and do the homework that allows others an opportunity to use that homework, whether it's a documentary or an article or a series of broadcasts or a special, an in-depth original investigative report, so that they can then have something to anchor their anger and their disappointment about. I'll give you a few examples. The drugging of our children. In one day, over a million people watched the documentary. And I was besieged with parents across America saying my kid was normal, started the drugs, started on the vaccines, and then went into this deep, dark place. And all the doctors are saying it's not the vaccines. But we know it is. As one mother said, who better than a mother that is there for every moment of that young child's life and knows every single mood and when they're hungry and when they're agitated, when they need to sleep, when they want a nap, the bonding? No doctor knows that as well as the mother. So if I tell you that my child was normal until the vaccines, and the doctor denies that, then I'm attacked, meaning the parents are being attacked by these trolls and these agent provocateurs who are hired by the vaccine companies, the pharmaceutical giants. And so it goes. So when you go out there to look for the truth and you find the evidence, and it's really overwhelming, and so I produce that evidence, and then that allows a movement of victims to be able to get back up on their feet and have congressional hearings or state hearings, or at least know that they're not mistaken. You've got 2 to 3 million parents who have been the victims as well as their children of this. And then think of all the children taking medications every day that they don't need for a condition that is rare, ADHD. And so once again, doing work on that. And then on the mental health, it's estimated that 20% of all Americans will be treated for some form of psychiatric condition, either depression or anxiety disorder, more often than not. But now they're even treating six-month-old babies for bipolar condition. Who in their right mind would ever be able to diagnose, let alone justify treating a baby that cries and laughs? So what, they're bipolar? And this is the bad science they're using. Almost all science and medicine is fraudulent or biased science. So bringing this to people's attention, showing it that you're not crazy, you're going through normal life's up and downs, but you don't have a brain chemical imbalance. But who didn't embrace this? The left. In fact, AIDS, vaccines, GMOs, nuclear, veganism, supplements, the power of supplements, organic produce, meditation and body-mind medicine, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, the fluoride contamination in our water, and anti-aging issues. Every time I would do a documentary or write an article, I would send it to everyone I knew in the left media, everyone at MSNBC, the Harper's, Atlantic. Not once did I ever even get a reply, just the courtesy of a reply. And some of these, like Poverty Inc., was the most awarded documentary in the world. And most of my documentaries are. If I added up all the documentaries, I would defy someone on the left to show me someone who's done more documentaries on more social issues that impacted people and yet completely denied. When I tried to get on a program, when I was invited on a program, I was censored. My freedom of speech was censored when I was on Guns and Butter to do a broadcast on the dangers of vaccines. And this was up for a vote in California, and the man heading this, a man named Pam, was aligned with the pharmaceutical industry on all this vaccine issue. But the public was not getting the real story, a more scholarly approach, a more honest approach. And yet, it was the left that was doing the censoring. And why? Why? And I told them at the time, if they make it mandatory so that every kid has to get vaccinated going to any public educational system in California, it'll only be a matter of time till they want to have adults do it, or they will try to make it illegal for anyone else to. Well, guess what has happened? Just today, there's now a piece of legislation that's working its way through and up through committees in the California legislature by this same doctor. And he wants now to make it a crime to be critical of vaccines. So it doesn't matter who you are. If you find that there's a legitimate reason to be concerned about vaccines, if California has its way, if these legislators that are pro-pharmacy have their way, then you could be in trouble. So this is crazy what's going on in California. But questioning vaccines ought to be a crime, according to a new bill by California Senator Richard Pan. Can I go out there and debate him? He won't debate me. Can I appear on public television stations to challenge the issue? No. So who did this? The left did it. And why? Imagine when I had all these original investigative reports, all shown to be completely accurate, not one of over 800 articles have I had to adjust. And I was finding supporting people who are HIV infected or had AIDS, that a healthy lifestyle could help them. In fact, my Tri-State Healing Center, where I donated for 10 years, I worked there for free. I paid the bills. In fact, I paid the bills for these persons with AIDS who were coming in because they were broke, and they needed high-dose vitamin C, like 200,000 milligrams a day. That's expensive. And the doctors who worked there, a whole group of board-certified physicians, they weren't working for free. But we were getting a lot of people well, saving lives. But when I went down to New York University Medical School and debated against AZT because I'd done my homework, four other medical doctors were for it. I was the only one against it. That began the character assassination. As this one panelist said, the moment you use your freedom of speech and inquiry to enlighten the public, you also make yourself an object that they can try to destroy you. There is no sensibility about it. And that's what they've been trying to do. Now, fortunately, unlike others who have been attacked for their point of view, I have a large audience, the largest health audience in American history, one of the largest audiences of any radio program in America. I was number one on ABC Network for years till I left. So it didn't work. The people who listen every day continue to listen, and they know the truth. But what about all the people who will believe that you're an AIDS denialer and they won't benefit from the information? They'll say, oh, I'm not going to listen to it. Or publisher, they won't publish something because, oh, we don't want anything to do with that guy. So there's a secondary impact, and that has been common. When I've seen people outside my lectures and I go out, maybe the two people, five people, not very many, and I say, what exactly are you protesting? And they tell me, I say, well, here's my textbook I wrote on AIDS, and it defines everything about AIDS. Here are over 37 articles I've written, all about natural ways of helping a person with HIV infection. Here's four award-winning documentaries I produced and directed, including the first one, AIDS, the Real Heroes, and every person in there had full-blown AIDS, and it said it right there, HIV-infected AIDS, and yet those people were helped using natural, non-toxic methods. Now, if you knew that before you were propagandized, before you became one of these front soldiers marching because you were told to, would you still be here today? And it confused them. You see, we don't have a program in the United States that allows people to redress injustice. And so we have all these little groups that believe that whatever they're being told is absolutely true. And so the people who have been in denial of the benefits of a more progressive way of living, getting off the grid, being conscientious, being a vegan, a plant-based diet. Go to the Left Forum, for example, and ask how many of you are vegan? What kind of food are they serving? What is their personal lifestyle? Well, how can you say you're for the people and you're for the earth and you're against capitalism, and then you go out and eat a hamburger from McDonald's, you drink a Coca-Cola, you're wearing some designer jean possibly made in Bangladesh? It's all hypocritical. When are you going to walk that talk? We haven't seen that yet, and that's unfortunate. So for all of the people who believe that the only truth in any movement would come from the left, that was a long time ago, and now the left is the supporter of anything you say, anything you do that they do not approve of. You're censored, you're boycotted, you're attacked, and the truth be damned. And that's unfortunate, because there have been some wonderful people at different moments in movements who cared, and they cared a great deal about the truth. But when was the last time you heard the left talking about ways of doing biodynamic farming, hydroponics to feed more people? When was the last time you had the left organizing to help homeless people live a better life, even taking them into their own homes? When? When was the last time that they were willing to look at the truth of the people that they've been supporting, including Hillary Clinton, and the truth of the corporatization of the Democratic Party? So That's why open, honest debate without censorship is so critical to a functioning democracy. But right now we have a substantially dysfunctional democracy, and the left has contributed to it. An awful lot of professors now are afraid of teaching the way they normally would, with vibrancy and with examples and history, because someone may get offended, in which case they might be reported. You heard several of these people were written up by one student in a class who didn't like something that was said. Is this the future? Is this the future of the left? Well, then you're not going to have much support, because the vast majority of people are watching all this play out like some morbid kabuki, and they're not buying it. And they're not going to adapt themselves, maladapt themselves to this identity politics. Nope. So they'll have their moment, and they'll terrify everyone on campus, and then their time will have passed. In the interim, global warming will have had a consequence. Economic deprivation will have a consequence. Inequality and the bubble bursting will have a consequence. Human health will go into a tailspin, which it is now. We're the sickest nation in the world. And young people are now showing signs of diseases of aging. So while they were playing politics in a petty way, a meaningless way, they did not do service to those like Gandhi, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and others, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, who came before them. I doubt if they would even know who these people were. And now, when their world starts collapsing, remember, you had a chance to look up, shed all those identity politics, and look for the truth. But you abrogated it. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need